Yeah, so the Gemara's continuing with the story about Sancheirif. And the Gemara says, again, starting with a pasuk from Divrei HaYamim, Acharei HaDvarim Va'emes Ha'ela, after these words and this truthful prophecy, Vaz Sancheirif Melech Ashur, Sancheirif the king of Assyria, came, Vayavo B'Yehuda, this is after he exiled the 10 tribes, he came to the Malchus of Yehuda in the south, Vayichan Al Ha'orim HaPetziros, he encamped on the fortified cities, Vayomer L'Bikam Elav, and he wanted to attach them, Bikam, he wanted to split them off from the rest of the lands, and attach them to himself. And the Gemara then says, Hai Dishana Lahai Pardashna. Why should this truth attach itself to Sancheirif? Meaning there's a bit of a problem here, because we just interpreted this prophecy to actually mean Yerushalayim would not fall in the hands of Sancheirif. In other words, the Gemara had a drasha before interpreting a verse that because of the Yegiya of Torah that existed among Am Yisrael, Sancheirif would not be able to conquer Yerushalayim. So then there's a non sequitur. The pasuk seems to say, as a result of this prophecy, Sancheirif went to Yerushalayim. That makes no sense. The prophecy would have, or should have, dissuaded him from going to Yerushalayim. Right? So what made him come after this prophecy? Because you could have learned he didn't know of the prophecy, but the implication is, as a result of the prophecy, he came to Yerushalayim. So what does it mean, as a result of the prophecy? So the Gemara says the following. Amar Ravina. Ravina explains, Li'achar shekafatz HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'nishva v'yamar, after Hashem Kavyachol swore and said, I amin alei l'chizkia, I seen alei l'sancheirev masarnala biyadcha, if I were to tell Chizkiyahu that I will bring Sancheirev against you, but I will deliver him in your hands, meaning that's what the Nebuah was, Hashta Omar, he might say, lo hu ba'ina, I don't want Sancheirev, v'lo bi susabina, I don't want the fear, meaning Hashem is wondering, shall I tell Chizkiyahu that Sancheirif is going to come with a huge army of 185,000 people and be defeated? Chizkiyahu might say, Hashem, I don't need your favors. Meaning, why do I need a huge army to come against me and be defeated? I'd rather not have the army at all. So, Miyad, Kafatz HaKadosh Baruch Hu, therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu swore, the nishva de maisinale. See, that's the lashon. It says, "Achar hadvarim v'ha'emes." It's an odd phrase. After these prophetic words, that Sancheirif will come, and emes, and the truth of these words. Now, what is the phrase "truth of these words"? So, the Gemara is darshaning. Something becomes true when you swear. Until you swear, right? If I say I was in New York, whatever it is, you don't really know it's true until I swear. If I swear, although a person can swear falsely as well, but swearing is a very deep affirmation of truth. So here is the point. Hashem decreed that Sancheirif will come and be defeated. But if Hashem wouldn't have made that decree with a shavua, there's such a thing as a divine oath, Chizkiyahu's sechus could have been to be mevatel the whole thing by saying, I don't want the favor at all. So that's what it means. Achar advarim, after the prophecy which Hashem swore, then Sancheirif had to come. Now, it doesn't mean Sancheirif came because he wanted to obey Hashem's shvuah, but it basically means Hashem made him come, meaning it's like Hashem hardening Paro's heart. Hashem made Sancheirif come, even though it was not a rational decision. Because now, why is that so? Because Hashem wanted the Kiddush Hashem of the army being destroyed. If it simply would have been Sancheirif wouldn't have come, people would not have known that was because of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They would have said he decided not to come. But by coming and being destroyed, there was a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. And therefore, this is the idea of Acharei HaDvarim, after the prophecy, the HaEmes, and the oath, that is when Sancheiriv came, because Hashem said, if I just would have told Chizkiyo that Sancheiriv is coming, he would have said, Lo'ihu Ba'ina, I don't need him, I don't want the problems. Miyad, therefore, Kafatz HaKadosh Baruch Hu jumped up, Kav Yachol, V'nishva, and he swore, D'maisin Olei, that I'm going to bring him, Shenemar, as the Pasuk says in Yeshayo, that Hashem did use a Lashon Shavua. Nishba Hashem Tzvakos Lamor, the God of hosts, the Lord of hosts, swore, Imlo Kasher Dimisi Kein Hayosa, that as I imagine, as I decree, so shall be, the Kasher Yatzihi Sakum, as I have counseled, so it shall be established. Lishbor Ashur Va'artzi, that Assyria shall be destroyed in my land, meaning Hashem wanted Sancheiriv to meet his destruction in Eretz Yisrael, not outside of Eretz Yisrael. V'al Harai Avosanu, and in my mountains I will trample him. Now he knew Chizkiyo's Zechus could have been such that Chizkiyo could have prevented Sancheiriv from coming. So in order to prevent Chizkiyo from changing the divine decree, there was a concept of a Shavua. And again, we don't really understand all this. We know the vocabulary. And that is, when Hashem issues a Gezerah without a Shavua, it can be annulled. Once there is a Shavua, it cannot be annulled. And the example is from the Chet HaMeraglim itself. The Chet HaMeraglim itself, was a, that the Jews have to wander for 40 years and that generation is going to die, was a gezar din sheyesh imo shavua. That's why we say in Tehillim outside the Kei, which is the first of the six Tehillim for Kabbalah Shabbos, right? Arboim shenal kut bedar, that Hashem fought with us for 40 years, and it ends during the Midbar, and it says, Asher nishbati biapi, I swore in my anger, Im Yevayun El Menuchasi, that they shall not come to my resting place, Eretz Yisrael. So you see, Asher Nishbati Biafi is a Gezar Din, Sheyesh Imai Shavua.
Can it be changed the way it comes about?
Which way do you say? Yeah.
Like the Shavua is that, like, whatever Hashem says will come about for sure. But, does that mean that the way that it will come about is set as well, or just that?
Well, usually HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaves it in ways that it can be interpreted in different situations, so it could be in a less severe way, a more innocuous way, you know, those things are always possibilities, although I'm not sure what that would mean over here. Here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's decree was, this is actually a good decree, this is not a bad decree, yeah. Actually, this is a decree that Sancheiriv is going to come and be destroyed. Mm-hmm. But Chizkiyo would have preferred that it didn't come, because imagine the fear that you have.
Right.
People talk? Say again?
Wouldn't people talk?
No one in Yerushalayim died. Nobody in Yerushalayim died. Sancheiriv's army of 185,000 people died the night before their battle. Now, they did wreak devastation on the rest of Malchus Yehuda. They did do that. But apparently Chizkiyo couldn't have stopped that. That would have happened because that would have happened. But Chizkiyo could have stopped his going against Yerushalayim. And Hashem didn't want to stop that because of the Kiddush Hashem that's involved. And therefore Hashem made a Shavua that Sancheiriv is going to come. Yeah. And that's what Omer Rav Yochanan, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yavo Sancheiriv V'siyato, let Sancheiriv come with his army, V'yaseh Avus. Oh, so now he's giving a little bit of a drasha here. Chazal always like to, these are midrashic translations of words. In the phrase, Al Harai Avusenu. So if you looked at your art scroll or a regular translation, Hashem says, on my mountains I will trample him. Right, that's the word avusenu. But Chazal see a little bit of a wordplay that an avos, same letters, different vowels, is a feeding trough. When you feed donkeys or horses or cows, it's an avos, a feeding trough. So the way we darshan it is the following, that Sancheirav and his army shall become a feeding trough for Chizkiyahu, meaning Chizkiyahu will be able to get all the wealth that the Assyrian army took. So as a result, we're kind of doing a double entendre, that the meaning of the phrase, on my mountains I will crush them, means on my mountains, the Judean mountains, the mountains of Yerushalayim, the hills of Yerushalayim. Actually, we're very modest in Italy, what we call it, maybe grandiose. And when we talk about the mountains of Yehuda, Hare Yehuda, we really mean the hills of Yehuda, right? These are not, Israel does not have the Alps or even the Rockies. The Mount Hermon is the biggest mountain in Israel. It's not that huge. But anyway, be it as it may, when it says, on the hills I will trample them, the drash is, on the hills I will make them a feeding trough for Chizkiyahu and his people. Okay. And then it goes on in darshaning the pasuk, right? This is what Hashem said, the promise, or Hashem's oath. V'haya b'yomahu yasur subalo. Yeah, promise. We're going back and forth between two different chapters. That's part of the confusion here. The Gemara is bringing in many, many different psukim from different chapters about Sancheirav, and we're just going back and forth indistinguishably. This is now we just read Perek Yedalud Yeshayo, and now we're going back to Perek Yud. V'haya b'yomahu yasur subalo me'al shechmecha. Yes, that the yoke of Sancheirav shall be removed from your shoulders. Meaning this is a good prophecy, right? The yoke of Sancheirav shall be removed from, or the burden of Sancheirav shall be removed from your shoulders. V'ulo, the yoke of Sancheirav, me'al savarecha, shall be taken off your neck. Meaning this is the good prophecy, meaning, right, this will happen. But then there's a strange ending here, which is hard to translate. V'chubal ol mipnei shame. Chubal ol. The ol, the yoke, shall be broken. Okay, so far so good. Because of the oil. Now the oil thing, again, this does not refer to petroleum or whatever it is. You know, you could say, but it refers to olive oil. So what does it mean, the yoke of Sancheirav shall be smashed because of oil? Doesn't fit. So the Gemara now says, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, Chubal ol shall Sancheirav, the yoke of Sancheirav shall be broken, Mipnei Shamno shall, again, this goes back to a point the Gemara made before, that the Zechus, that Chizkiyahu had, that the Assyrians were not able to conquer Yerushalayim, was because of the toil in Torah that they had, the Yegiyah of Torah. So here we're describing that Yegiyah with the use of, we even say in English, burning the midnight oil. When a person, before electricity, right? If you were learning into the night, you would burn an oil lamp. So that's what it means. The yoke of Sancheirav shall be broken because of the oil that was burning at night in Yerushalayim when people were learning Torah, right? That's the drasha, v'chubal ol mipnei shemen. And that's what Rav Yitzchak Nafcha says, chubal ol shel Sancheirav mipnei shamno, because of the oil of Chizkiyahu. But it's not just Chizkiyahu as a person. Remember, Chizkiyahu's zechus was not his own learning only. It was that he created an environment where everybody, even little children, were learning Torah constantly. Shaya Dolek, Bebate Kinesiyeh, Subbate Midrashes. Chizkiyahu had lights that were lit in all of the shuls and all of the study halls. Ma'asa, and what did he do? Well, Chizkiyahu seemed to have a good way of enforcing attendance at Seder. Maybe we should do it here. Noatz Cherev al Pesach Beis HaMedrash. He took a sword at the entrance of the Beis Medrash. Now, presumably, this means there was a guard, so to speak. The Amar, call me She'eino Osek B'Torah. Anyone that is not learning Torah, Yidaker B'Cherev Zeh, will be stuck with this sword. Now, this could mean a few things. You know, you could mean it literally, although, once again, he wasn't going into people's homes looking for them, but at least if you were in the Beis Medrash, you were bobbling, stuck with the sword. But it probably is something else. It probably meant more like a Musar talk, so to speak. Just reminding people, something we should think about now, that if you don't learn Torah, you are vulnerable to the sword of the enemies. Meaning, the sword was not a sword that the guard was going to use on somebody, but it was like a graphic reminder. Remember, your learning is not just a luxury. Your learning is not just a nice thing to do. We don't learn. Chas v'shalom, the enemy will come in. And again, this was not just a nice thought, because remember that the northern kingdom of the ten tribes was decimated by this enemy. So in every Beis Medrash, there was a sword that reminded people that if we don't learn the Dagir B'Cherev, we could be stuck with the sword. Okay? And that's the drasha, Chubal Ol Mepnei Shemen, that it was the oil, the late night oil of this Torah learning that broke the yoke, the potential yoke at least, of Sancheiruf.
What was it about this that they learned it not that caused the destruction of Sancheiruf?
We don't know specifically. In other words, why night more than day? Yeah. So that's a general thing. Then the Rambam says generally in Hilchos Talmud Torah, even today the Rambam says, a person gets most of his chachma at night. Now, there is a machlokas how to learn this idea. Is there something special about night? Or is night simply, it wouldn't be so relevant to a full-time learner, but night is relevant for someone who during the day, you know, works. So he spends his nights, instead of watching television or whatever it is, he spends his nights learning Torah. So for you, in other words, if you had a choice, not like, let's say I have a choice, let's say I could learn 10 hours a day, I can make my schedule any way I want it. Would there be a special point to do it at night, or no? As long as I learn 10 hours a day, it makes no difference. So that really depends how you learn. Some people say there was a special idea of night. Other people say night was simply the time when people were panoi from other things. Even today there are different gedolim of different customs. Some gedolim, they may go to sleep earlier and get up very early in the morning. Others learn late at night and get up later. For example, the Brisker Rav, I think it was God, I don't want to be mostly lost, but I think the Brisker Rav, I believe, did not, who was extremely, not only as a gadol, but extremely medactic in mitzvahs to do it according to the Hidurim. The Brisker Rav did not daven Vasikin, although most of his Talmidim got up to daven with the sunrise. He did not daven Vasikin, and the reason was, he said, that once he's learning at night, he can't stop. Meaning, to daven Vasikin, you got to get up early, you got to get up early, you got to go to sleep a little earlier. And if the Brisker Rav was in Esukia, he would go till 2, 3, or 4, whatever it is. So Mamela, even though he knew by the time he went to sleep, he would not be able to daven Vasikim, but that was his shita. Other gedolim, like Rabbi Yoshev, had a different mahalach. Of course, he was learning at night anyway. He would go to sleep like at 10 o'clock and get up at 2 o'clock. And his main learning, I mean, not his main learning, but the time of night which he had undisturbed learning was from 2 to 6. And then he would daven Vasikim, but I'm trying to remember. I believe he did, and I was thinking, what if Vasikin is earlier? Did he stop early? I have to check. I think maybe he did not stop early. He felt that retzef, that consecutive learning was so important that he would not stop it early for Vasikin. But no, but the days that he could make Vasikin, he would do it. So they're different scheduling. So we're not going to say there's something magical about those hours, but it means that when people were panoi, they were Isaac the tyrant. Yeah. And now it mentions how successful Chizkiyahu was. Batku midan v'ad Be'er Sheva. The Chachamim conducted surveys from Dan. Now Dan, the inheritance of the tribe of Dan, was the furthest north of Eretz Yisrael. It's Don is a strange, because Don actually had two different portions, both on the west bank of the Jordan, not on the east bank. On the east bank is only Reuven, Gad, and Chassi Shebe Benasha. But on the west, Don had a portion in the center of the lands, and a portion up north. Don was also split. So the famous biblical expression, that's still used in modern Hebrew today, that when you want to talk about all of Eretz Yisrael, from the north to the south, you say from Dan to Beersheba. Now, it's a little bit of a strange expression, because Beersheba is the south, but Beersheba is the beginning of the south. The whole big Negev is south of Beersheba. But apparently, even in the time of the Torah, south of Beersheba was very sparsely settled. So the inhabited areas of Eretz Yisrael were until Beersheba. So from Dan until Beersheba, Lo Matsu Ama Aretz, they did not find anyone that was ignorant of Torah. 100%.
Even in the northern parts, that's the best indication of the...
That's a good question. Actually, that's a good question. Midan v'ad Beersheba. Midan is one of the 10 tribes. That's a very good question. Even in the north, because in the north, number one, there are two questions with that. Number one, Chizkiyahu did not have jurisdiction over the north. They were under another king. And number two, the north was exiled. So obviously they didn't have the Sechus of Torah. So what do we say about this? We've done until Beersheba. I mean, I would tell you, although there's probably a better answer, there probably is a better answer, that, you know, Dan Beersheba is just an expression for all of Eretz Yisrael, but sometimes we use expressions even if they literally don't apply in this situation. But, well, sorry, there should be a better, I mean, perhaps there's a remez here, you know. There is a remez that, just like we say, Oy l'Rasha, Oy l'Shchayna, alas to the Russia, and alas to the neighbor of the Russia, meaning we get influenced by bad neighbors. And conversely, what do we say? Tov l'tzadik, tov l'shchena. So maybe there's a remez here that Chizkiyahu's intensive campaign of Torah did have a spillover effect. Now, the spillover effect wasn't great enough, perhaps, to save them. But it means that even the 10 tribes were elevated, which is a pretty remarkable achievement, since there actually were armed guards that prevented Jews from going from the south to the north. I mean, the northern kingdom did not want Jews to go to the Beis HaMikdash and everything else, but there still was a spillover. And it mentions that they were bodeg from Gavas to Adat Tifras. These are two other extreme cities. Lo Matsu Tinak V'Tinakis, they did not find a young boy or a young girl, or Ish V'Isha, or a mature man or a mature woman. Shalom hayu b'kiyam b'hilchais tumah v'tayra. I mentioned this before. Not only do they generally learn Torah, but even in the very difficult laws of purity and impurity, which are very complicated halachas, everybody was a bucky. They knew these halachas. And we actually see that there's another description of Chizkiyahu's generation. Again, we're taking another pasuk from left field. V'al oso ador hu omer. In reference to that generation, it is written, now this is a prophecy that's going all the way back before Chizkiyahu was born. That before Chizkiyahu was born, there would be a prophecy that he would create a generation of intensive Torah study. And we get that from also an enigmatic pasuk. The pasuk says, V'haya b'yomahu. It shall be in that day. This is before Chizkiyahu was born, and this is a nevuah about Chizkiyahu. Yiya ish eglas bakar ushtei tzon. Every person will have eglas bakar, a calf, and two sheep. So obviously we're going to give a drasha here. The Yomer, then it goes on and says, V'haya b'yomahu, in that day, Yiyah kol makay mashiyah sham elef gefen bielef kesef. Every place where formerly there would be 1,000 vines of grapes, a vine of grapes, that would be purchased for 1,000 pieces of silver, lishamir ulishayis yiyah shall be thorns and thistles. So, this now, when you take this literally, this sounds like a pretty disheartening prophecy. That places that have great agricultural productivity shall be reduced to thorns, but the drasha is positive. The drasha is saying that people will ignore the potential to make money in order to study Torah. That's the reference here. That this was not a prophecy of destruction, but it's as if Hashem will say, look at the greatness of this generation, that even land that they could have, you know, made a big farm, a big vineyard out of, they will not bother. They could have gotten 1,000 pieces of silver, whatever that is, like $1 million, because they wanted to learn. Now, I understand that. What is the first verse? What is the verse about the calf and the sheep? The Gemara does not give us an interpretation of that. That's what Rashi says. Always a little perplexing in Agarata why the help of fortune is so sporadic. In other words, you don't have like something on every phrase. I mean, they just skip a phrase or skip a drasha, and they don't tell you anything at all on it. I literally see no interpretation of this phrase at all. What is the idea of Eglas Bokor?
Is the reason because they just went to ask questions about it?
Well, the Gemara brings in, the Gemara is trying to show us that this was a generation that was so involved in Torah learning, and it then wants to move us to the fact that even before Chizkiyahu was born, there was a prophecy that this is what he would accomplish. And it cites two verses. One is that day, this is before Chizkiyahu was born, but in reference to his reign, it says a person will have a calf and two sheep. And on that day, if they had land that would have produced 1,000 vines for 1,000 pieces of silver, shall be for thorns. And it then proceeds to explain only the second verse, that even if you could have gotten 1,000 pieces of silver, it'll be abandoned because people will be learning Torah. So, I mean, the Gemara is clearly bringing in that first pasuk to teach me something about this as well, but it's not clear what it is, unless there's a remnant like this. You know, on Shavuos, we have dairy products, right? We have milk. And one of the reasons, there are a few reasons, is that Torah is compared to milk, and milk and honey. And we also say that a Rebbe is compared to a cow, that because the Talmud nurses her, just as a calf nurses from a cow. So maybe the reference that people will have a calf, meaning they will eagerly nurse from their Rebbein. They will eagerly nurse. So that explains Egel, it doesn't explain sheep. I mean, sheep also nurse through, every mammal nurses, but I guess we say that the image we normally use is that of a suckling cow, a calf, because a calf, eats more than a sheep. I'm going to have to check, but okay, but this is the drasha that we have. And then, the pasuk says, V'usaf shalalchem osef hachasir. Okay, so now we're fast forwarding. Again, this is why you really need a Tanakh when you learn Gemaras like this, because we're going back and forth. Some psukim are from before Chizkiyahu was born. Other psukim are before Sancheiriv attacks. And a third group of psukim are after Sancheiriv was defeated. And here the pasuk says that when Sancheiriv will be defeated, Usaf Shalalchem, you, the Jewish people, will be able to gather your spoils of war. Osef hachasil, like the locust, just like the locust consume everything, you will be able to consume the spoils of victory. So Amar lem Navi LeYisrael, the Navi Yishayo told the Jewish people after the Mapala of Sancheirev, Isvu Shalalchem, gather your spoils, take. So Amru lo, so they asked the Navi Yishayla, Livzos, should it be each soldier to himself? Olachlek, or should we divide everything? Again, this is exactly in last week's Parsha, the war against Midian. So if you remember, there were huge amounts of spoils, of animals, and wealth that were taken, and the Torah gave us a very specific way of dividing it, that 50% would be kept by the army, and 50% would go to the general population. And of the 50% taken by the army, 1/500 is given to the Kohen, Elozer the Kohen. And of the 50% taken by the nation, 1/50 is given to the Levium. So this was a situation. Now this was only true for animals and the maidservants. The men were killed. In terms of gold and silver, the Torah says, every soldier kept his own. Whatever gold and silver you plundered, you were able to keep. So sometimes we find the Torah says that spoils of war are divided, and sometimes the Torah says, whatever you take is yours. So they ask the Navi, do we, each one keeps his own, or do we split it? So that's why he said, you will gather it like the locust. What does it mean, like the locust? Ma Aisef HaKasil, right? Locusts not like ants. Ants are more altruistic a little bit. Ants bring things back into the storage area, and it's available for everybody. A locust, each locust does its own, meaning a locust does not save for another locust. That's why he uses that expression. Ma Osef HaKasil, Kolechav Yechad Liatzma, Af Shalal Chem, Kolechav Yechad Liatzma. But then they raised another halachic question. Hello? Mamon Aseres Ashvatim Uruba. Since Sancheirev's army had decimated the 10 tribes, so among their property is not only their property. Again, let me just show you, the halachic concept here is that when you vanquish an enemy, their property belongs to you. That actually is a halacha, that through the conquest of an enemy, their property now becomes hefker. But their question is, well, what about the Jewish property, the property that belonged to the 10 tribes? Shouldn't we be obligated to hunt them down and give it back? You know, there were some survivors. So Amar Lahem, so that explains the next expression. Again, it's something that Agarita does a lot. And again, without a Tanakh in front of you, I'm just, even though I'm not doing it myself right now, but it's always helpful to really understand these Agaritas that are so connected to verses. Unfortunately, we don't know Tanakh very well. You should have a Tanakh in front of you. And basically, the Derech of Agarita in many places is, it takes a continuous verse, divides it up into categories, and says each part of the verse is in response to something that was said that's not in the verse. Right? So when the verse says, you shall gather your spoils like the gathering of locusts, that's all it says. So the Agada says, you split it up. The Navi said, gather your spoils. The people asked, should we divide it, or everybody keeps their own? Answer to that is, like the spoils of the locust. In other words, that part of the verse is an answer to a question that is not stated in the text. And that's what Agadita does. It often kind of says, these words are a response to something that people said. Now, similarly, the verse goes on and says, after it says, like the spoils of the locust, Kemeshek Gevim Shokek Bo. You should suck up the spoils like the sucking up of a body of water, of surrounding moisture. Again, the analogy would be, if you have a marshland that's very, very wet, and you have a pool of water, although, again, water does not suck up water, so to speak, but the water gravitates downwards, Right? So so if you look at the mental picture, it's as if the pool or the lake is sucking up the water. In other words, so it uses two metaphors. Take spoils like the locust and like the pool that sucks up the water around it. What is the need of that metaphor? So we say the pool is actually a kosher mikveh. It's a natural lake. So it's making the point, you are like a mikveh, meaning just like a mikveh, if a person is tameh and they're tovel in a mikveh, they become pure. So too, the property of Yisrael got kashered by being conquered by Sancheiru. Meaning, the idea is pushed like this. The idea is that the notion of ownership by conquest applies to Goyim too. Meaning to say that when Sancheiru destroyed the 10 tribes or exiled them, his nation acquired ownership of the spoils. So when Sancheiru is vanquished, you're not taking the property of the 10 Shvatim, you're taking the property of Sancheiru, meaning Sancheiru's conquest is like a mikveh that changed the status of that property. You actually find this rule in the Torah itself, although not vis-a-vis Jews per se. The Torah says we are not allowed to conquer territory belonging to the nations of Moab and Ammon, because Moab and Ammon are descended from Lot, and Lot was Avram's nephew, and they were given lands east of the Jordan. And the halacha is that until the days of Mashiach, we are not allowed to wage war or take any land belonging to them. On the other hand, we did take land, right? The land that is east of the Yarden belonged to Sichon, the king of the Amori, that is one of the seven nations. We did conquer that land, and that land belongs to Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. Now the problem is, if you read the Torah, you will discover that Sichon himself, the Amorite king, waged war against Moab and conquered a lot of the Moabite territory. So a lot of the territory that the two tribes settled on was in fact Moabite territory, which the Torah says we're not allowed to conquer. So how could that be? So the Gemara explains, and this is the actual language of the Gemara, Ammon and Moab Tiharu became purified through Sichon. Now that doesn't mean spiritual purification, but essentially we didn't conquer it from Ammon and Moab, we conquered it from Sichon. And that's the exact point that's being made here, that we did not take the property of the 10 tribes from the 10 tribes. It had already belonged to Sancheiru by virtue of his conquest, or belonged to the Assyrian nation, and therefore we took it that way. So the same way that we got Moabite land via Sichon, we got the property of the 10 tribes via the conquest of Sancheiru.
When Hashem said don't attack, didn't Hashem use the word Moab?
Well, the term that he used was Al Totsaris Moab. Oh,
okay.
Do not wage battle against Moab. That was the term.
I just thought it was very interesting that the same way in which if a woman who has a chutz condition on her get gets married to a new person,
it doesn't use the word chutz, but I hear what you're saying. I see a drawing analogy. There's an intermediate person that allows it.
What was David the Hamelech center to conquer Moab?
Yeah, so the hatred to conquer Moab, it says, because Moab was attacking Jews. In fact, Moab actually killed. It's interesting that Yishai and David's brothers sought refuge in Moab during a famine and the like, and the kings of Moab murdered them. So Moab was it was acts of aggression against the Jewish population, so you are allowed to fight the Moabites when they attack you first. But you don't initiate a war against the Moab. And now today, of course, we're not allowed to initiate war at all. We could only fight defensive wars. But when there was a Sanhedrin, there was a concept of even a war of aggression if it was authorized by the Sanhedrin and by the Urim V'Tumim, which is really Hashem giving you permission. So today there's no such thing.
And in a war of defense, can we actually conquer land?
It would appear that if it is a defensive war, you could even conquer the land. But that's not so clear. You know, I'm not sure. Yeah, 67, but the question, you're allowed to do it generally, but the question is, could that be true with Moabite territory?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. The Raya is that you couldn't, because because the Gemara says that when Sihon attacked us and we took land, it was only mutter because it was already not Moabite. The implication is, had it been Moabite, even if we would have been attacked, we wouldn't have been able. So the implication is that Moabite territory, wherever that is, unless it's in the possession of another nation, could not be seized, even in an offensive operation.
If we were to have attacked Moab and conquered them, what would have, does Hashem tell us what would have happened?
No, we're not given a consequence, so it's hard to know what the consequence would have been. It's basically Hashem's statement that I have given this land to the children of Lot until the Mashiach comes, at least vis-a-vis the Jewish people. It was a reward. Lot was Abram's nephew. He was given a certain share.
So then David HaMelech still needed a further hint to actually occupy.
Yes,
occupy
the question would be, what was the hetzer to occupy? So the only answer I could think there is that if that's necessary for the defense, that would be okay. In other words, it's one thing if you have a specific threat, you get rid of the threat, then you leave. It's like Israel and Lebanon, right? Same thing. That Israel remained in the 80s, Israel remained in Lebanon many, many months after, it went into Lebanon to get rid of terrorists. It stayed there for a very long time in order to ensure that there was no threat, and then they left. So perhaps David HaMelech had to be in Moab because there was an active threat that's going on. Just like our soldiers may have to be in Gaza for a while again. Unfortunately, the casualties are going up, but it's just amazingly frightening. These underground tunnels, I'm sure you've been reading them. How many are there? 13, 14, 20, who knows how many? These huge tunnels that mamish go into Eretz Israel. Imagine you can be in the middle of your house.
Yeah.
20 people come up from the floor. And they're booby trapped and all sorts. It's a very, very dangerous situation. The UN, of course, Kedarko, Bakodesh, is going nuts over Israel's trying to defend itself, protect itself.
Should we even be trying to, I feel like it's kind of ridiculous to even try and convince the other nations of, why we should. I mean, it's, on some level,
Although the U.S. has been pretty good pretty unusual. Kerry, is not condemned Israel.
Yeah, but Obama's don't.
Okay, well, Melissa Obama has to say something, but Obama is much better than he usually is,
right. Surprisingly
enough. But the UN is going crazy. The UN is a Security Council meeting, etc. With the great human rights activists on the Security Council, China, Iraq, whoever they have there, the great humanitarians. Hamas keeps on putting, Hamas puts children there from where they are, and then they complain when these things happen. I mean, Israel gives people warnings, calls them up ahead of time. When suicide bombers don't give you warning, please don't take the number 39 bus today. It's gonna they don't give you warnings, Israel gives them warnings, tells them to evacuate, tells them this is what we're going to do. People can leave. Hamas says, if you leave, we're going to shoot you. So people are forced to stay, and then these things happen.
Would it be the core brand for us for them not to send those messages, because of those messages, people come, and because of the messages, they have our ability to ambush. So
it might be. The truth of the matter is, the Israeli army gets criticized so much. There is no army in the world where the soldiers put themselves in such danger to avoid casualties to civilians. There are people who have said, halachically and militarily, the Israeli army is too considerate of civilians. Okay, it's a good question, but at least you see that there is a reverence for the lives even of the enemy. The other way, we care much more about their lives than they care about their lives. Not just about our lives, but their lives. They put everybody in harm's way, and then we keep on telling them, "Get out! Get out! Get out! Get out!"
Does that go against some of them to sacrifice Jewish lives over?
Well, you're not supposed to sacrifice Jewish lives, but there actually is a din in the Torah that when you wage war against the enemy, you cannot surround them on all four sides. You have to give them a fourth side to be able to escape. Now, there's a machlokas rishayim, what the reason for that law is. Some rishayim say it's humanitarian, that, you know, you should try to avoid a total massacre of the enemy. The other says the other way around. If an enemy feels closed in, they're going to fight with greater ferocity. So by giving him an avenue of escape, they'll be less passionate. Anyway, Rav Schiller told me a cute thought. That he says, you know, we talk about bringing people to Torah as waging a war for Torah. So he says, the same way in a war, you're not allowed to surround somebody by all four sides, because if they don't have an avenue of an escape, they're going to fight back ferociously. So he says, when you bring a person to Torah, you have to be gentle. You can't, like, surround them. You can't trap them that they have no choice, because then they're going to fight back, right? So you have to give them a little bit of an escape, you know, that they don't have to, you know, kind of sign up on the rest of their lives in yeshiva or something like that. And only when you're gentle and you give them the avenue of escape, they're more likely to listen to them. That's good. That's a very good comparison. Okay, well, be it as it may, this Gemara is very, very relevant to us. We see here it was the Zechus of Torah that gave Am Yisrael the victory over this tremendous enemy that was going to destroy Yerushalayim. And now we are in a state of war, and we have to know as well that this, what was true then is true now, that the zechus of the shemen, chubal ol mipnei shemen, that the yoke of the enemy will be broken because of the oil that is burnt, or the electricity that is used in Torah learning. So this is, again, this is your great, great contribution to the war effort. I know that the whole issue about drafting Bnei Torah is not relevant if you're not an Israeli citizen, but it's a controversial issue. But L'chol HaPachas, right now you're not in the army, right now you're here. So you have a very, very important contribution to the victory of Am Yisrael. So it's all bizarre to see that issue.
Should we put a rocket in the
Yeshivas? Right, well, that would be the idea, put a rocket picture of a rocket. You don't want this to happen, so do this. Right? That's a good idea. That would be based on the Gemara. You know, you're following the Ramban's advice. The Ramban writes in his famous letter of the Ramban that whenever you learn something, you should always ask yourself, how could I put this into practice? So you learned the Gemara today, you can put it into practice. Make a poster. Okay.
Thanks, Rob.